Okay, the final talk of the day is Bill Martin here. Bill's going to be talking about war, robots, technology, warfare, capitalism, all that kind of thing. So we'll see how that goes. Okay, over to Bill.
Thank you, Chair, comrades and friends. Okay, so that was... I put that up on the screen. Originally, I was going to do something from mixed martial arts or the like to show the brutality of a human fight or natural. But I decided in the end that mixed martial arts is particularly unpleasant to watch because they basically grapple on the floor for 10 minutes until one guy gets kicked in the head. So that was just a bit of a classic boxing match, just to illustrate what human beings fight like as human beings. In fact, that's a... Obviously, as it's boxing, it's highly regulated and deeply unnatural way of fighting. And of course, in reality, as I think we alluded to a bit earlier, the natural way for a human being to fight, if they really mean it, if they're really going into a fight, is actually to pick up a rock or a pointed stick and try and kill the other guy properly. So even that's not the natural way of fighting. The natural way of fighting that humans have, as such, is to use tools. So a couple of years ago, I did a talk here entitled Here Come the Robots, the main thrust of which was that developments in technology and productivity would essentially possibly could drive down the labour component of manufacturing to zero, to examine the possible consequences, the possibilities of how that could come about, and to just generally look at some of the political consequences of that. This talk follows on from that idea, and it's going to look at how warfare is one facet of this productive process that we humans produce war, and we produce violence, and that it comes out of it, violence and warfare relates to the totality of social relations, and doesn't just relate to the actual materials of production and warfare, but to ideas, social structures, and it reflects the society that we're living in very strongly. And in fact, I'm going to put forward something roughly resembling a model of warfare as competition in a marketplace, and look at that in relation to the further development of the means of slaying, which is a line that I was particularly proud of, and how this is going to relate politically to the development of armed forces. And then I might, if I'm feeling particularly generous, show you some robots, and then hopefully wrap it all up and try and edge cannily towards something resembling a political conclusion. I owe Mike an apology. See, in my title slide, no exclamation marks. The number of exclamation marks in Here Come the War Robots has varied tremendously from time to time. This slide was originally entitled Trotsky Was Right, to be nice and provocative. But I thought it's a good place to start is with Trotsky, because after all, the guy organised a war. So he kind of knows what he's talking about, and he also knows about technological warfare, as you can see from his lovely shiny armoured train there, that he would ride up and down the tracks fighting in the Russian Civil War. And this is a bit of an extended quote, I'm afraid, which I nearly forgot, so thanks to Mike for reminding me that I needed bits of paper. And this is from his fifth volume of military writings, where he's taking issue with various people, the sort of people who believe that you can have a Marxist theory of beef stroganoff, and say, well, no, there's not a Marxist theory of war as such. But what he does say is, after a quick swig of water, war is a certain form of relation between men. Consequently, methods and procedures in war are dependent upon the anatomical and mental properties of individual man, upon the form of organisation of collective man, upon his technology, his environment, both physical and cultural, historical, and so on. The procedures and methods of war are thus determined by changing circumstances, and therefore themselves can in no wise be eternal. Man's basic psychophysiological and anatomical structure has not altered to any considerable extent. Needless to say, the laws of nature have remained the same, but the relations between man and nature have changed a great deal. That artificial muir which man interposes between himself and nature, tools, instruments and machines, has grown to such a degree as to transform completely methods of the work, the organisation of work, social relations. There has undoubtedly been preserved since the days of Troy the urge among human groups, nations, classes, in brackets, to exterminate, conquer and subjugate one another. The artificial mirror of or human technology, in the broad sense of the word, has transfigured war just as it has transfigured all other human relations. Undoubtedly, even in the period of the Siege of Troy, this goal was being attained not by means of nails and teeth alone, but with the aid of artificial weapons which man interposed between himself and his enemy. This most general basis remains unchanged. In other words, war is a hostile encounter between human groups equipped with instruments for killing and destroying with a direct aim of winning physical dominance over the enemy. Well, I apologise for reading a very long quote, but I thought it was particularly apt for what I was trying to get at with the substance of this talk. And particularly apt, I mean, Trotsky himself, I sometimes marvel that Trotskyists wonder about his writings and rave about him, because whenever I read him, all I seem to see is go back to your constituencies and prepare for civil war. He is, in fact, a one-note donkey. But if it, at least he knows all about that civil war and how to fight it, because he did one. So I think that he makes a very important point, that human beings do not fight with our fists. I mean, despite this report that came out a couple of weeks back that apparently our faces have evolved for being punched, or at least mine has, humans are spectacularly unarmed. You know, I mean, realistically, to kill someone with your bare hands is actually quite a feat. And so, as we were saying in Richard's talk, weapons are a great equaliser, because they change the whole nature of fighting, because no one is immune to a pointed stick through the heart. Okay, so my second detour, and why let a good obsession go to waste, I say. Obviously that's Machu Picchu, or whatever it is, the capital of the Incas. But I think it's a useful step back in time to go back and look at the classic model of a historical mismatch between technologies. Because the whole business of Pizarro coming into the Inca Empire and taking over is redolent with kind of the plot of a B-movie, in that the Spanish conquistadors turned up heavily armed and they conquered one of the mightiest empires in the world at the time. And that spanned a vast area all along the Andes. It's now Chile, Peru and bits of Bolivia. And this is the classic model. Now, there are problems with the sort of like the classic narrative of the conquest of the Incas. I mean, some of the bits that get left out are that before the Spaniards even turned up, upwards of half the population of the Inca Empire had died of smallpox. So they've just had a massive plague. The country itself was falling apart due to internal tensions and a civil war, possibly provoked by or exacerbated by the plague. But nonetheless, it is the classic example of a distinct advantage being gained through technology, and not just through the actual instruments of technology. So if I just want to go through what happened during the alien invasion. Now, you could argue that the conquistadors had steel weapons as well, which would have been a distinct advantage, because obviously they won't break. But at the end of the day, a man armed with a sharp piece of metal is going to be roughly as effective as a man armed with a sharp piece of stone or a sharp piece of wood. The real advantage that they gained from the metal was the superior armour, in that they would be wearing breastplates and helmets. Okay, their swords would have been stronger and they would have had pikes and things, so that would have been one distinct advantage. The second advantage that they had would have been gunpowder, which is a tremendous, especially to people who have never heard of it, advantage. But of course that meant that they could project the force over a great distance and do a lot of killing, because obviously they did actually have cannon, or at least mini cannons. And the third thing that they had was horses, so they could manoeuvre much more quickly and efficiently. And the reason why I'm bringing these three things up is it's useful to sort of like see that all of these things are also useful for non-military purposes. This is an example of technologies that are just generally applicable, that would be useful. You know, you want to move around, move things around, move people, manoeuvre. Horses are good for that. Gunpowder, good for testing the strength of alcohol. And steel is generally useful for making implements around the place. The one thing that they also had was that they had highly developed military tactics. Now, this relates very strongly to the social structures of their respective societies. The Inca emperor relied upon being able to call upon the direct labour of his subjects, and in fact in common with a lot of the societies of Polynesia and South America, it wasn't being a chief was as much about being able to command the support of your men and people as it was about the ceremonial title of being a chief. And their mode of warfare was to wait until they had double the number of the opposing people. They'd stand before them doing ritual chants and standing there and going, right, have we got enough yet? And when they had enough, they would go in and massacre them. That was the plan. As you can imagine, that's not much of a plan. But it's as much about the whole ritual, making sure that you double and outnumber them. It's about a way of fighting. It's not just about winning the battle, but making sure that you've won over your followers and that they feel confident in going out. And of course, a rough equivalent of military force between people basically armed with stone clubs. That's the way you fight. You make sure that you just have more people than the other guy. And that's how you win, just through sheer weight of force. Whereas Pizarro came from a society that was very, very different. There, you had basically what you would amount to free-range serfs, peasants who lived in their villages, and you didn't have to bother with them. You didn't have to bother about their support or getting their command or anything like that. All you had to do is come along with a military force, take their surplus, and go back to your heavily defended castles. So it's all about a tiny minority that can dominate through military equipment, military force, and being able to regularly fight, to be in fact regular fighters. And so that means that they developed a highly organised sense of military strategy, tactics that were built around manoeuvre and being a small force of professional fighters. Of course, it didn't hurt that Pizarro also had the precedent of Cortes and what he did in Mexico, in the Aztec Empire, before his eyes to copy him. And so they've done this once already. They come down to the Inca Empire and they try the same trick again. And of course, the Incas didn't think that they were gods. They wondered who these strange and weird people were with the big pointy weapons. But of course, they eventually, this is the other thing to remember, they were lured into a city where they were caught in a crossfire, effectively an ambush where they were killed in very great numbers, which broke the morale of the army and took the emperor hostage. And it's, you know, part of the alien mythology that the conquest of the Incas was inevitable. You have to bear in mind it took 30 years or more to actually subdue them. So it's, even with a distinct edge in military technology, outcomes are not always inevitable. But also we have to bear in mind that the technology relates to the whole of society, and that shapes not only what you have to fight with, but the way that you fight and the way that you think about fighting and the purposes to which you put the combat. So this is a chart of scary numbers. And of course you've all heard the phrase that an army marches on its belly. Well, this is... to be honest, I don't care if the figures are 100% accurate or even remotely accurate, as long as someone has consistently made a conscious effort to try and get good data reflecting the population of the United Kingdom, of England, and the agricultural population. And it's from an article about agricultural output in England. And the useful thing to notice, so in 1250 here, we have a population of about 3.8 million people. So not a huge population when you think about the size of England. And of that 3.8, 3.05 are busily engaged in agriculture. That is, people that are busy working the land and aren't available for fighting, essentially, or at least they're not available for fighting when the agricultural time is needed. And you can see the population growth going down through the ages. The ratio barely changes until we start getting down to about, by the 17th century, we're getting to about half and under. And, I mean, just the important point here is that you can see the trend going on downwards to this agricultural population of 0.1 million in the 1800s. This is the time, these later times are the times at which European armies start to get very big, and you start to hear about battles between tens of thousands of men. Whereas, you know, in the War of the Roses and, you know, the early wars, if you had 10,000 men on the battlefield, you were doing particularly well. That was a substantial force. But, you know, by the time we get down to the mid-18th century, this is the time we're talking about people having armies, standing armies across Europe, of 100,000 or more, and therefore entering into a competition of who could get together the biggest army and deploy the most people on the field. And when we start to get the outcomes of 19th century, 18th and 19th century wars, in which you know, you start to get towards the catastrophic numbers of fatalities in war that we eventually lead to World War One. Because obviously, you know, the actual agricultural population required to keep the country going was so small they could afford to send lots and lots of men out. But this is just a by way of further illustration of how even something as unlikely as agricultural productivity frees up population and men for warfare and relates. So they, again, this is something that's not, you know, directly immediately needed for warfare or related to it, but it still has a very shaping effect upon the nature of war and the way it is fought, going from a handful of knights to large standing armies of conscripts and as Richard said yesterday, of bringing the peasants out, because now you've got enough peasants to feed everyone. So this is something I'm sure Richard is very familiar with. This is a chart called from Wikipedia to show world military spending in relative terms. It's possibly not the best way of displaying it. Note the very dark colour on the USA, as they spend over $500 billion per annum. Note that the next country down is China there, and they're spending somewhere in the region of, well, there's been recent reports that the US are unhappy with the way that China reports itself. It says it spends $124 billion. The US reckon they're spending somewhere like $174 billion. How sneaky and despicable for a country not to detail exactly what it's spending on military resources. I mean, you know, who would have thunk that they would do something like that? But I think the more important way to think about it is that at the present, I believe it's the US alone is spending more than the next 14 military powers just on its military direct control military forces. But there was a point I was going to make there. Or do I just move on? Oh, the point is that the United States has a military strategy of being able to say it can stand up and beat any other one country in the world. And that's the plan. You know, and in fact, as they've just demonstrated in Afghanistan and Iraq, they can do two at a time. So that this is eminently within their grasp. Now, whether or not they could, in a knockdown fight, take out China is an entirely other matter. I suspect it's now got to the point where China certainly is too big to take on without horrendous losses, irrespective of the possession of nuclear weapons. So now we're getting closer to the robots. This is, okay, it's a couple of years old, but it was a nice pie chart. And this is United States military spending. And the one that I am interested in is this one. Research, development, testing and evaluation. So they're spending $79.1 billion a year on their direct military budget. Now, this gets a bit complicated, because obviously how do you work out what is, as I've just said, what is actually military technology research? Given that, as I've indicated, almost any research can lead eventually to military applications, because that's the way that military minds work. You know, the Wright brothers flew their first plane in 1903, yeah. I had a toss between 1903 and 1909. But within 10 years, 11 or 12 years, they were flying planes and trying to kill each other in the air in the First World War. So, you know, it's obviously the military applications are fairly readily apparent, but, you know, something as innocuous as a couple of guys in a shed inventing a plane led directly to, you know, well, to the bomber. And the other thing, I think I made a note, my rough back of a fag packet calculation is that the US is spending about 11% of the world's, assuming everyone spends about the same ratio, that'd be about 11% of the world's research is going on in the United States. But of course, you know, some people criticise, certain individuals have criticised Noam Chomsky for working for MIT, because some of his linguistics funding was about natural language processing potentially as a useful tool for fighter pilots. But of course, anyone working in a modern university, at some point there will be money that's come from either military sources or that will eventually end up being military sources. It's very hard to disentangle the entire civil university project from these very, very specified military side of it. But that notwithstanding, I mean, it's still a tremendous figure to think of $79 billion being spent each year working out how to, well, not just how to kill people, but how to get people to the place to do the killing and get them back again, and to make sure the people who do the killing don't get killed. So that's a very important part. How do I... But it's not just the government. Obviously, this, you're all aware that the arms industry is a big business. And here's a kind of the scale of the business. So Lockheed Martin is pulling in $36 billion in 2011. And making a profit of $2.5 billion. I mean, you know, that's stratospheric. And of course, they'll have their own R&D division that will be funded out of their own pockets and out of their own profits, and they'll be investing to try and make the best weapons that they can sell to everyone in the world, because that's, after all, how they make their money. Of course, each of these, especially BAE systems, are highly linked to the various respective governments, because obviously UK arms sales are a branch of foreign policy. You know, the governments that Britain supports, like Saudi and Bahrain, they need to be protected by being sold weapons. And I suppose in some ways, arms sales are the modern form of tribute extracted from empire. I think I've not taken down the note, but there is something, I think, in the region of $2 billion is being spent by these sorts of companies on cyber warfare and counter cyber warfare, how to protect your yourself from the computerized robots of the internet. So the fact that this is now a substantial part of the spending of the private companies indicates how technology is already bringing home the reality of robot warfare to the organized armed industry. And of course, I now come to the ubiquitous Charlie quotes. I think there's a couple of things. As I said, I was trying to present something resembling a model of business and of the capitalist of capitalist industry. Because obviously, the whole point of capitalism is to do things well, to command as much, use as much labour as little as possible, is the way I put it in my previous talk. That they want to be able to stake a claim to vast amounts of labour and the vast amounts of productive labour, but not actually use labour directly themselves. And of course, a lot of you will be very familiar with this notion from the first volume of Capital. The machine proper is therefore a mechanism that, after being set in motion, performs with its tools the same operations that were formerly done by the workman with similar tools. Whether the motive power is derived from man or from some other machine makes no difference in this respect. From the moment that the tool proper is taken from man and fitted into a mechanism, a machine takes the place of a mere implement. The difference strikes one at once, even in those cases where man himself continues to be the prime mover. The number of implements that he can use simultaneously is limited by his own natural instruments of production, by the number of his bodily organ. So we can start to look at what point does a weapon stop being a tool, an implement, and start being a machine. Now, the most successful weapon in history, the one that has been used most and most often to greatest effect, is the pointed stick. It's got antiquity, it's got standing, it's been used for a very long time, and even in the Iraq War, its modern version, the bayonet, was actually used by British forces who engaged in a bayonet charge in a modern war. I suppose if they practice them, they have to use them. But that's a mere implement. That is, you could argue, you could ask the question: is a bow and arrow a weapon, a tool, or a machine? I've seen video footage of a guy who could fire 3 arrows a second. In the hands of someone properly trained with an arrow, you can do a fierce amount of damage. But it's still probably, you would say, still only up there as a tool. What is the first machines of war? The chariot? The horse? I mean, a horse is a tool, is a machine more than a tool, because it carries the man, it does much more work than he could naturally do with his own body. Is a bomb a tool or a machine? You know, the nuclear bomb that landed over Hiroshima vastly increased the killing capacity of the pilots of the Enola Gay. But by the same token, that was just one bomb. whereas the machine gun is a machine that fires repeatedly. But the point I'm trying to get across really is that until really the 19th century and the early 20th century, machines didn't come into warfare as such. That the coming of capitalism and the coming of the notion of competition through the improvement of machinery suddenly brought that same principle to the battlefield. Whereas in the past some tools and implements and weapons did come to the fore, suddenly now we were into a competition to try and go, well, if we can do this in the workplace, if we can do this in commercial competition, we can do this in the competition of the battlefield. And I think that although it's not directly comparable, because obviously there's no necessarily monetary exchange or value involved in this process, but Marx's notion of surplus profit and the competition and the technological drive for that, I think, provides for a useful, and if not an analogy, it's a useful way of thinking about the material competition of industrial warfare. The assumption that the commodities of various spheres of production are sold at their value merely implies, of course, that their value is the centre of gravity around which their prices fluctuate, and their continual rises and drops tend to equalise. There is also the market value, to be distinguished from the individual value of particular commodities produced by different producers. The individual value of some of these commodities will be below their market value, that is, less labour time is required for their production than is expressed is the market value, while that of others will exceed the market value. On the one hand, market value is to be viewed as the average value of commodities produced in a single sphere, and on the other, as the individual value of the commodities produced under average conditions of their respective sphere and forming the bulk of products of that sphere. It is only in extraordinary combinations that commodities produced under the worst or the most favourable conditions regulate the market value, which in turn forms the centre of fluctuation of market prices. The latter, however, are the same for commodities of the same kind. If the ordinary demand is satisfied by supply of commodities of average value, hence of a value midway between the two extremes, then the commodities whose individual value is below the market value realise an extra surplus value or surplus profit, while those whose individual value exceeds the market value are unable to realise a portion of the surplus value contained in them. By which, I mean us to understand not that the market... Well, obviously, a lot of these, as we saw on the previous screen, means of warfare are being produced for a sale in the market, but that if you think about it in terms of a comparative advantage, then in a world in which everyone has military force, there is a distinct realisable value to be had in having a better, more efficient military force than the guy next door. And that the competition will always be to invest in new and different ways of applying military force more efficiently using less labour, because in military terms, labour is a political cost. Because if you commit troops to a battle and they get killed, that has ramifications at home. So they want to save labour. They want to use as little as possible and to be the most efficient fighting machines on the market and to be able to outfight everyone else. And of course, that means that everyone else is also investing and improving their means of production. You have to stay ahead of the game, just in the same way that every individual capitalist has to stay ahead of the game. So effectively, introducing machines onto the battlefield has introduced the cultural logic of capital onto the battlefield. So whilst a capitalist or a machine user can develop a more effective and efficient implement or set of machinery in a given task or field of endeavour, they will gain a certain edge. But the corollary, the problem with this, is that as with capitalist production, what you do then is you end up eventually cheapening the means of production. Because as you get more and more efficient and produce more and more cheaply the instruments of producing, you lower the barrier for later people to come into the market. And of course, this is the AK-47 for when you absolutely, positively have to not finish the quote from Samuel L. Jackson. One of the most successful and popular small arms and weapons of the modern era, partly because the Soviet Union shipped them around the world as part of helping out with various guerrilla wars around the place. But they're still, because it's still tremendously popular because it's essentially very easy to maintain and probably quite easy to make as well, because it wasn't made with what would now be considered the cutting edge of technology. So, of course, if you are considering entering into the armed war business, you can get hold of, as recently ISIS has, you get hold of a crate load of AK-47s and suddenly you're in business. And even the Taliban, essentially, that's their stock in trade, is having a few handguns secreted around the place. And it means that they can start to compete with military forces like the United States or other countries that have spent vast amounts more than they have. So you're now faced with, as industrial technology increases, new entrants come onto the market all the time using the cheapened machinery of death. But that's not all, because not only do you have legitimate late entrants, you have all sorts of varieties of free riders. And this is very annoying. I'll come to what's on the screen in a second. I mean, the most basic type of free ride nowadays would be found in some European countries who don't bother spending as much on military equipment as perhaps their situation would demand, because they can confidently rely upon the United States coming along and fighting their wars for them. So they're protected by the states. They don't have to spend the money. The US tries to make out that it's not a traditional empire, and so it doesn't levy tributes and you know, tax its subject peoples. So what it does instead is it turns around and says, well, actually, you're not spending your fair share on military equipment. As part of NATO, you have to pony up and build your own military forces. That's the deal. And, of course, that's why it's almost certain that should, by some fluke, I'd think nowadays at the moment, Scotland vote for independence, it's already been told it's not allowed to leave NATO. There's no way it would ever get out of NATO, because the United States demands it. But, of course, there's other types of free riders. This here is it's a photograph taken from RT, and it purports to be a surveillance drone built by Iran. And they claim that they shot down or a US drone crashed on their territory, they've taken it apart, and they've nicked the technology. So the US has spent all this money on developing drones, on developing and research and development of new technology. They lose one and suddenly someone else has got it for a fraction of the cost, if their claims are true. But of course we know that quite a few years ago now, under the Bush administration, a spy plane crashed on China, and the United States went and said, can we have our plane back please? And the Chinese said, yeah, in a minute. And they gave it back, and it was all sparkly and clean all the way through. So this is just as in any market nowadays, you know, you think about it, that other people can enter in. You know, pirates. That's a serious problem, you know, since the internet came along in the music industry, and, you know, illegal copying. That as soon as someone works out how to do it, they can join your market and steal your edge almost instantaneously. And as my previous talk discussed, the approaching singularity is that technological innovation speeds up, and the gap between invention, implementation, ubiquity gets increasingly shortened. So that as soon as you invent something new, it will become ubiquitous within a couple of years, rather than taking 20 years and giving you 20 years grace of being the superior power with the superior technology. But that direct sort of copyright infringement isn't the only way. Of course, any averagely competent industrial power, once it knows that something is possible, can go off and design it itself and go, well, okay, we don't need to know exactly how they do it. We know that it is now possible to put a drone in the air for 48 hours. We've got physicists, we've got, you know, we can see roughly the shape because they put it in the newspapers. Whatever super secrets are in there, we can replicate as well. And this is a Russian drone that you can kind of gather from the Russian at the top there. And they reckon that this thing could stay in the air 48 hours and could just hover around the world and then drop leaden death on the push of a button. And of course, this illustrates, I think, something else, that this the market in military technology is in fact almost a purer market than in most domestic capitalism, because you can't enforce copyright internationally, there is no Leviathan saying, no, that's a copyright infringement, you're going to have to pay a penalty to the United States for nicking their idea. This is, if a piece of technology comes into being and it works, other people will borrow it and they too will soon have your technological edge available to them. So it's almost, warfare is the market taken to extremes, or the market is a form of warfare, whichever you prefer. Right, so time for the doggy. I'm sure some of you have seen me posting this before, but I promised robots, and here we go. This is actually from 2002.
Did
it actually
make that noise?
Yeah, well, no, it's so dumb, but the man just kicked it, and it's staying up on ice. Leave it there. The important thing to note, I mean, isn't that suddenly there's going to be robot dogs being unleashed by Mr. Burns, like, US capitalists determined to hunt us all down and tear us apart. The point is, if you think about the machinery, the computer power, the processing power that it takes to get this thing to even faintly replicate what an animal does naturally, it is a tremendous amount of technology. And of course, I mean, I think actually the limitations of this thing is going to be its battery power, because it'll have no range at all. But of course, the reality is that this, you know, you could send out these things in places of mules. They're all terrain, so they can go places that even caterpillar tracks would hesitate to go. And they can just send it off on its long journey. Yes, you could put a weapon on it. It could be weaponized quite easily. But it's a shame Simon's not here, because he would tell you that one of his favourite aphorisms is amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics. And so if you have an all-terrain robot that could just send large chunks of equipment into the forest or what have you, even through the mud, that is something that could be incredibly useful. And of course, the military mind would look at that. They wouldn't just think straight away, put a gun on it. They might well do. So that's big dog. And of course, this has got some of the crazies on the US right going absolutely mental, because the governments are going to come at us with killer robots, man. We're a long way off from that. I don't think that's really. See, I'm being defeated by the machines already. I mean, this is the reality of advanced warfare. And anyway, it doesn't matter. The key point is that this is a drone centre. And of course, we've all heard of the drones, and they are now a controversial part of the capitalist arsenal, that these planes are just floating in the air. A target's acquired, they know where he is, down goes the bomb, they take him out, and it's an instant kill. And this is now an accepted part of reality. It's incredible to think that the idea that the United States president on a Tuesday afternoon looks at a list of playing cards, they call them, photos of potential targets, and says yes or no to each killing, and effectively set himself up as judge, jury and executioner in a way that most tyrants in history could probably not even dream of. And the order goes out, and the sentence is carried out that day. You know, completely contrary to anything resembling Republican values in the United States. But apparently this is now our normal reality. Apparently, you know, you read the histories, and it probably is true that Stalin used to sit down and look at the mugshots of all the people who'd been executed that day, and this was taken as an example of him being a raging psychopath. Obama does it, and it's him valiantly taking the moral responsibility for killing onto himself. There's been at least 3 drone strikes in the last week that I've seen reported in the press, probably killed about 70 people. They may or may not have been militants. Who's going to find out? You can't ask them. They've been blown up. But this is now the way that the United States is wanting to wage war. And again, this is all coming back to levels of efficiency, whereas before, to kill Osama bin Laden or the people like him and to disrupt the network would have required thousands of troops, extremely difficult operations. Now they can get down to almost godfather-like surgical assassination. You know, they don't have to kill lots of people, they have to just kill the right people with highly targeted, highly focused. And of course, it doesn't totally save labour, because as we just saw, there's hundreds of people involved in keeping one of those things in the air. it represents a huge investment of fixed capital, of dead labour, turned into a drone flight. And as they try to make clear in the news report there, the pilots still operate under the normal conditions of warfare, the rules of warfare that they would operate under if they were in a manned plane. You know, so it's, they're trying to reassure us that it's absolutely no different at all from what we are currently used to from the military and its ways of working. Oh yes, here we go. I do have some more stats. This is from an interesting article. I've got links to all my articles at the end of the PowerPoint. 55 leaders of Al-Qaeda and Taliban were killed by drone attacks between 2004 and mid-April 2013. They were a small fraction of the total number of people killed in drone attacks in that period, which the organisation estimates at between 2003 and 3,321. In Yemen, the number of Al-Qaeda leaders killed since drone attacks began under Obama is 34 out of an estimated 427 to 679 killings. That's from an article on robot warfare, which also makes the interesting point that the whole, when you develop new technologies and new ways of killing people, you become more inclined to use them. They're only using the drones because they can. These people would not have been hunted down and killed previously because they would have been just prohibitively expensive, and no one would have wanted to go to that amount of effort to take these individuals out in the way that they're being taken out. But because we have the technology now, these things are flying through the air and striking at will, which I find rather disturbing because I'm Will. Come on. Right, so not only do we have unmanned ground vehicles, such as Big Dog that I just showed you, there's no video associated here, but we have unmanned, aerial unmanned vehicles, AUVs. This variety that I've got a photo of, developed by NASA, it's solar powered. So effectively, you could end up with AUVs flying around forever, or until a vital component breaks, with no fuel limit, which is a considerable thought. And, I mean, futurologists and technophiles are getting very excited about AUVs because they're talking about just having them floating around in the air above parts of the world, attaching a wireless network and bringing internet in the middle of the Sahara Desert or anywhere you like, where anywhere completely beyond the normal reach now. But of course, these things are massive, but you might have seen these quadricopters, which they're only small, but you could mount a camera on one and just have it flying over a demonstration or whatever and photograph things. And so they are thinking that they're going to be the new big thing. And of course, Amazon, we're discussing using AUVs for delivering packages. So the idea would have been that your parcel would have been flying overhead and then just dropped down onto the pad on top of your house. And of course, if Amazon are thinking about that for us, the military are thinking about delivering essential supplies to their frontline troops in the same way. They're just a quadricopter, keep yourself reinforced. And again, it's all about logistics. It's the robots replace the people, but they don't necessarily have to be doing the killing themselves. This is kind of the concept. We bought a book at my work on stealth ships, and the whole notion of a stealth ship, I find, you know, because they're big bloody things, they're quite hard to miss. Apparently that is a prototype of one. And of course, I discussed on the party's forum a while back, we could have robot ships going around the world soon. When we were talking about having robot cars, what about robot ships? Brilliant, you wouldn't have to worry about having space for people. You just have a ship out there with a gun, you send the code, bang, and it goes in. These things are becoming increasingly possible. And of course, I suppose the ultimate would be a stealth robot ship, or even a stealth robot ship aircraft carrier. And in fact, in my research and travels, I did find apparently drones are now able, they have enough, can't call it intelligence, enough processing power to land on an aircraft carrier, which is being considered to be the supreme feat of a pilot. You know, because it's not an easy thing to do, to bring a vehicle down and land it on that tiny patch of metal that is an aircraft carrier. So you could end up with robot fleets flying sailing around the world with robots on them, with turning out drones and AUVs, and being part of a vast network. Of course, this is all coordinated through satellites, which would therefore also mean that there'd be robot killer satellites trying to knock out everyone else's satellites. Hours and hours of endless entertainment. This is the campaign to stop killer robots, there are actual genuinely proper a genuine campaign group now that's lobbying the world to put a moratorium on autonomous killing machines. The guy with the pink tie there is Noel Sharkey, who's a roboticist, and he's in the media. He's a professor at Sheffield University, and he's now one of the leading lights, or at least he's a prominent member of the campaign to stop killer robots. And in an article, he discusses his objections, and one objection is, he says, well, at the present moment, a robot can't spot a combatant from a non-combatant. But I think that's a relatively weak argument, because what happens when robots become good enough to tell the difference between a combatant and a non-combatant? And in fact, his fundamental position is, it is morally obnoxious to delegate the decision to kill a human to the computer program. It would cross a fundamental moral line to allow the decision to kill a human to be delegated to a computer program. It is ultimate human indignity to have a machine kill a human without a person making that decision. I personally can't say I agree. I don't necessarily think it's as bad. As I say, if someone has declared a combat zone and all combatants and all soldiers in that area are told to shoot on enemy combatants, then I don't really see the difference between telling a soldier to do that and telling a robot to do it. Even if the robot is only 99% as good as a human, it's still carrying out the orders. I think what would be extremely worrying would be if robots could make the tactical decision to declare an area to be a combat zone, or to declare the decision to deploy. Because at the present moment, if you send out a robot and say, well, kill anyone you see in that area, it's a human making the decision to send them still. And I, you know, it's no different from sending the order to a soldier. At the point at which robots gain strategic value and that they can do our strategy for us, that becomes incredibly more problematic, I'd suggest, than the campaign, than having a robot do any killing at all. And of course, I think it would be almost a standard party rejoinder to the campaign to stop killer robots. Yes, but what about the killer humans? I think they should be stopped first. And this standpoint of it feeling that it's just simply unarguably obnoxious to get a robot to do it has been at the nub of a number of films from the United States recently. This is the up-to-date version of RoboCop, which itself is an artistic response to drone killings, because it says, well, you know, we've been sending out these drones, what would happen if these drones were brought back to our streets? And then robot police were invented, and okay, it's a comedy and a flight of fancy, but it brings back the whole point that this is about. Warfare is about politics. It's about achieving your ends. So if you had the point where robots could govern strategy and control the military, where would we stand? Now, I think, in part, the idea of a world dominated by killer military robots is fanciful, but partly because the whole point of being the human elite is to dominate and control other human beings. I think at the present moment, robots wouldn't be able to corral us, as has been proven in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's one thing to have the military capacity to knock out an army, it's another to control a human population altogether. But I suppose the question becomes, you know, hitherto revolutions have depended upon a degree of disaffection in the army, meaning the army, as fellow humans, as fellow workers, coming over to the side of the revolution. What happens when the capitalist elite can rely on an army top to bottom made up of robots that can make new robots, that can control strategy, that can decide to fight in their interests? It brings into relief the very possibility that they could command, stay in position for a very long time, because we would not be able to stop them. All it would take is one drone strike and this room's gone. No, I think we're safe just for now. But you know, you think about it, it's the level of surveillance in our society, if they brought it, you know, they decided that it was in their interests now to, or at some future point, to use this militarized robot force. Or even if it doesn't replace humans within the military, the fact that the number of human components begins to get smaller and smaller, so that you only have to rely on a very tight tight cadre of men to keep your military force intact and operational, and be able to take out and disrupt everyone else. And what happens when the killer robots become cheap? When they become ubiquitous? When people can start to send out their own killer robots? Because, you know, it came in a pack. And you send it to the shops to go and rob it. You know, these things are questions that we need to consider, because that's, again, the corollary. On the one hand, we've got the vast investments of the capitalist class, the military machine of the Western world. On the other hand, we will have the long tail of technology becoming available, meaning that, well, come the socialist revolution, perhaps the recalcitrant minority of pro-capitalists will be able to defeat us militarily. And we will not be able to, we'll have to rethink our tactics. So I think that the point of this talk is very much that we need to take into consideration this improvement in the means of slaying and the advance of capitalist technology. These are my notes, these are the copyright clearances, and, you know, where I did my research. And do we have any conclusions we want to come to?
Thank you.